eventually built a property on this site near here called Porter Hall. One Thomas Willis of that family in his day was an eminent physician. He was a doctor. Amongst his many discoveries, he was in fact the first man to fully diagnose diabetes. If we now jump to the 1800s, there was on this site a modest Victorian property, acquired in 1882 by a London stockbroker. His name was Sammy Neal. He came here with his second wife. Sadly, his first wife died in childbirth. He expanded that Victorian property in this rather grandiose mansion you're within today, a very deceptive building, some 60-plus rooms. Not built as one, but over a period of years, and the last elevation to be completed is the one within the moment, which was built just after 1905. As a stockbroker, he travelled extensively, so from his travels he gleaned architectural ideas, so every room's got different plasterwork, paneling and presentations, and of course the facade is no exception. He also built up a substantial home farm with pedigree herds, flocks of sheep, etc. Behind the house, a simple veg plot, 4 1/4 acres, including hot houses and coal frames. The estate was self-sufficient, and then very extensive gardens, parklands, and playing fields. Despite all his domestic commercial duties, he also finds out to become a Liberal MP. Lord George used to be a frequent visitor here. In 1911, he's awarded the baronetcy. But finding the title, Sir Samuel, or within that, he reverted his first name and became a very distinguished Sir Herbert Lyon. And he and his wife, Lady Fanny, lived here till their respective deaths. Sir Herbert died in 1926, leaving some £700,000, which today, of course, you can convert into tens of millions. Lady Fanny, however, died in 1937. Now, there had been 4 children out of the 2 marriages. They'd all established themselves, so they decided to dispose of this estate. It was divided up and put up for auction. The home farm sold readily, as did various other parcels. The mansion, however, together with its immediate and substantial acreage, did not reach its reserve price and was withdrawn at £7,500. It was eventually acquired by a local builder, an entrepreneur called Captain Hubert Faulkner, and his intention was to walk into this building, strip out all the plasterwork, panelling and other artefacts, and sell all the items off, build his own private house on a cricket lawn which overlooks the lake, and then raise this building to the ground and develop the rest of the estate into housing. Fortunately, he was forestalled. He was approached by some men from the ministry. A lease was taken on the property for a period of 3 months, and then a group of people under the guise of Captain Ridley's hunting and shooting party arrived. Well, they obviously evaluated the site, discreetly disappeared, and thereafter you could say it was subject to compulsory purchase. So who but the men from the ministry? If we go back to the First World War, there had in fact been a very efficient operation run within the Admiralty, based in room 40 of the old Admiralty building, and they were intercepting the communications of the German Naval High Command to their fleet on the open seas. These communications were protected by book codes, which our authorities successfully read. So the Admiralty was well served. At the end of the war, of course, with no more bulk traffic to process, the majority of staff had to be demobbed. But a selected few were kept on under one commander, Denniston. In December 1919, that department was fused to a military operation and given the title of the Government Code and Cipher School. And eventually, responsibility was passed from the Admiralty to the Foreign Office in 1922. During the 20s and 30s, the Government Code and Cipher School inevitably created codes and ciphers for the use of own authorities. And to practice the art of code breaking, they actually had people posted overseas. Now, after the war, Germany had been demilitarized, so technically no threat. In the meantime, our authorities were very interested in America, but in particular, Russia, China, and Japan. So certain members of staff were attached to embassies in the Far East under the guise of being called passport officers. But their true function was to eavesdrop on local communications, which again were being coded in one form or another. The intercepts were duly made, communicated back to London via radio station, then based at Barnes, passed the Government Code and Cipher School, where the specialised teams applied the magic art, and then, of course, the relevant intelligence passed on to the appropriate authorities. Towards the end of the 1930s, however, it was more than apparent that a Second World War would take place. As London would be bombed, certain organisations needed secure premises to go about their business. So the actual acquisition of Bletchley Park was achieved by Admiral Sinclair, who was then head of the Secret Intelligence Services, as a war station on behalf of various departments, which also happened to embrace the Government Code and Cipher School. And they moved in just before the outbreak of war. The relevance of this site is typified by a map dated 1937, which is hanging in our video room, at the back of the mansion, a map which holds good until the late 80s, early 90s. It shows this area as being totally rural. It was all fields, hardly any houses at all, one might stay, of course. Also, it shows the estate. Now, the estate in the family days was substantial, and in those days, physically abutted Bletchley Station. In fact, such was the wealth of the family, they actually had their own private entrance. Bletchley Station, of course, is on the main line from Euston to the north. In those days, there were 2 active spur lines, one running to Cambridge, the other running to Oxford. And and then within a mile of this site, a major trunk road, the A5, Watling Street. The word trunk denotes cabling. Coupled that with the telegraph wires on the railway lines, effectively in a totally rural and secluded area, this site had the benefit of transport and communications north, south, east and west, therefore perfect for covert activities. The challenge facing the government coincided school in the event of war would be, of course, to intercept the enemy's communications and break whatever method of encoding they used. Now, the method of communication in those days was the use of Morse code. Of course, Morse code is an international convention which technically anybody can read. So the Germans, in common with every other nation around the world, disguised that traffic. And they used code books and a variety of different procedures. But the Germans in particular had the benefit of a formidable cipher machine called Enigma. Now, the concept of Enigma is originally a Dutch invention. It was actually developed and patented by a German man called Arthur Schoenaerts in the very early 20s. In its original format, the machine looked like a typewriter with certain cogs on the side. It was designed for commercial use, but commerce did not take it up. In 1926, however, it was adopted by the German Navy and totally modified, and then subsequently adopted by the Army, Air Force and other agencies. And it ended up looking like a portable typewriter. And of course, a typewriter is not. In common with the typewriter, it has a keyboard, but the keyboard only reflects the 26 letters of the alphabet. Immediately above the keyboard is what we call the lamp board, again each valve illustrating one of 26 letters of the alphabet. So in simple explanation, you press a key, a valve lights up, illustrates a letter, and that is the enciphered letter. The complication of this machine, however, is twofold. On the front, a plug or stecker board, and on the top, a scrambling unit. Up to December 1938, the Germans had the press of cross-plugging six pairs of letters. And within the scrambling unit, three rotors. Now each rotor is numbered and distinct. So, one, two, and three. But of course they can be installed in different orders. So, one, two, three, one, three, two, three, one, etc. Around the outer perimeter of each rotor, the 26 letters of the alphabet. On each side of each rotor, in a roundel, 26 electrical contact points. And within each rotor, which makes them distinct, a separate wiring. Which means when an electrical current goes into the first rotor, because of its wiring, it comes out at a different point. Then it goes to the second rotor at the corresponding point, and again, with that wiring, out at a different point. Into the third rotor at the corresponding point, and again, with that wiring, out at a different point. It then hits a unit at the end there called a reflector board, which is crosswired and pushed back through. So effectively, the electrical current is going to zigzag its way in and zigzag its way out. So, practical demonstration. Press the letter L in the bottom right-hand corner of the keyboard. If L is being crossed by to A, it now works as A. A goes to the scrambling unit, zigzag in, zigzag out, and then it comes out as the letter B. But if B is being crossed by the letter A is the valve by itself. So it's quite easy. If you press the letter L a second time, you get a different result. Because every time you press a key on the keyboard, the right-hand rotor advances one notch, which means the wiring is now changed. So, you press the second time, you're still crossed back to A. A goes in, zigzag out, and maybe this time it comes out to the letter L. And if L is not being crossed back to another letter, L is above the right side. When the right-hand rotor has been through a full revolution, it pulls a little rotor one notch. And if you keep pressing the keys enough time, the back goes through a full revolution, it pulls a third rotor one notch. So on a straight selection of rotors, you can potential of 36 times 36 times 36 different combinations, or in excess of 17,500. In December 1938, the Germans enhanced the performance of this machine by increasing the plug in the front from 6 pairs of letters to 10 pairs of letters, and they also introduced 2 spare rotors. Now, the Enigma was used by the German Army, Navy, Air Force, and various other agencies like police, secret police, military intelligence, general intelligence, railways, post offices, etc. Each and every one of those authorities had its own cipher department. And they would therefore prepare, on a monthly basis, special sheets to be issued for their respective operatives. And this is an example of a sheet issued by Luftwaffe in 1944. Each day of the month is identified, and against each day, the configuration will be applied. The selection of 3 rotors from the 5 available, and their specific positions, left, middle, and right. Equally, their start positions, because they're actually programmable with the use of locking predictors. And then the 10 pairs of letters to be cross-plugged from the front. Depending on the organisation, there were then further procedures. Shall not complicate matters. These settings came to force at midnight of the day in question. Once the operator's got his machine set up, he can then take a message and press it on the keyboard. His assistant writes down the enciphered text from the lamp board. It's then passed to the radio operator, in Morse code, the enciphered text. And maybe 100 miles away, the corresponding radio operator writes it down, passes it to his Enigma team, who provide what they've got, exactly the same selection of rotors, star positions, plugins, etc., etc., can then process in ciphertext on the keyboard or from lab board with plain text. It's reciprocal, it's a letter pair machine. But one mistake in a setup means it doesn't work. It's taking pentagon. So obviously, you're only privileged your own organization's monthly sheets and nobody else's, therefore you can't read their traffic, but equally, they can't read yours. Totally unsecure. But worst of all, it was a mathematical nightmare. That overall combination of settings meant that the likelihood of anyone valve lighting up and press any one key is actually excess of 158 million, million, million to one. So a pound on the lottery at 40 million one tonight is quite a good bet. Well, the good news is the experts here broke Enigma, and they also remember continue to break every other method of encodement used by the enemy, their allies, etc. And as the expertise grew, it could be said that by the end of say 42 in particular, we basically knew what was going on in every theatre of war. It's always good news when you know that immediately other reflections come to play. Due to time, distance, logistics, etc., the authorities weren't necessarily able to respond. Now, pre-war, Commander Denison had not been allowed to employ anybody. So when they first came here, they were only about 180 strong, albeit in the minority against the other departments. We didn't take out 40-odd people who were in what we call the construction department, people who created codes and ciphers, take out the cooks and various other allied staff. You actually come down to a very small number of experts. By the end of the war, however, this was a formidable operation employing some 10,000 members of staff. It was unrelenting work. It was given 3 shifts a day, 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year, and they achieved so much. The type of people who are appropriate for the art of code and cipher breaking are people with applied minds. Now, pre-war, Commander Denison had not been allowed to employ anybody, but luckily, he'd had some foresight. He'd actually been to Cambridge University in particular and approached various professors of mathematics, and after due interview, invited them to join the team here in the event of war being declared. And that's exactly what happened. The day after the war was declared, a whole series of people rolled up for duty. In fact, they ended up taking all the professors of mathematics and the graduates from Cambridge, then Oxford, and then all the other universities. They were still looking for people with applied minds. And today, when we look down the road of honour, we find an extraordinary range of talent, amongst whom can be included scientists, musicians, Egyptologists, archaeologists, museum curators, which would be bank managers, bank tellers, actors and actresses, chess players, crossword puzzles, set of songs and the like. A wonderful range of talent. And you mustn't forget the many, many linguists that were here. This was a worldwide operation. 12 war ran its course, and we all know the outcome. At the end of the war, of course, there was a major predicament. What to do? Now, this had been a top-secret war site, totally closed. Everybody who worked here signed the Official Secrets Act. They weren't allowed to tell their families and loved ones where they worked and learn their contribution to the war effort. It also worked on a cell system, a need-to-know basis. Thus, if you worked in this room, you didn't have a lamp above, below, adjacent, or anywhere outside. If there's a partition down the middle, the odds are the people on this side did not have to have that, and vice versa. So the overall secrecy of achievements here was very, very well disguised. Well, as you know, at the outset of the war, Russia was allied to the Germans, and following Operation Barbarossa, they became our allies. Towards the end of the war, however, the political climate was changing, the Cold War was developing, so it decided this site should be closed down, and nobody but nobody should ever know about our expertise in the art of coding cipher breaking. So the majority of the staff had to be demobbed, and as a consequence, all had to reaffirm the Official Secrets Act for a minimum of 30 years. A selected number of people stayed on in the business, and they moved down to a site in North London. Now, whilst here, there were, of course, a variety of excuses to justify their wartime activities. And for some, because of all the communications coming in and going out, they were allowed to refer to themselves as working for the government communications headquarters. So those people stayed on in the business, moved down to the East Coast in North London, and then in 1952 on to Cheltenham. This is, of course, the foundation of GCHQ. So the staff are dispersed, the communications get ripped out, the machinery and trappings of war destroyed, the surface papers get burnt, so it might be said by the end of 1946 there was no vestige of wartime activity here apart from the residue of the buildings. Well, eventually the post office took over this site, using the mansion and various outbuildings as their principal training centre. Other outbuildings were used by a variety of agencies. A succession of teacher training colleges were here, DSS, magistrates' courts, the Civil Aviation Authority had a ground radar training school here, and even GCHQ used certain buildings for courses about which we told nothing. Nobody but nobody who came here post-war ever learned about the wartime activities. The story broke in 1974, and the book was written by a man called Winterbottom, The Ultra Secret, done from memory, not totally accurate. But even then, the authorities refused to acknowledge the wartime activities. Well, the post office moved on, British Telecom took over, and they continued to use the site, and then in the very late 80s, they decided to build a new training centre at Milton Keynes, which had been developed in the northeast of here. And with land prices rising, which to capitalise. Well, cutting a long story short, some people who knew about the activities here called a reunion, and we now have the British Bank Trust. a private trust, so as such we don't receive any public funds at all. Albeit, I put a special caveat on that, English Heritage very kindly produced some £300,000 to help us complete the re-roof of the mansion just before Christmas. Very, very welcome indeed. So, it's with pleasure we welcome you here, because basically it's the gate money that keeps us going. We let out rooms and buildings as offices. We have functions here, corporates, conferences, we have licensed for weddings, we have dinner dances. In fact, you name it, we'll throw it. Then to earn an income to maintain the integrity of the site, but in particular, commemorate the activities and achievements of the magnificent people who worked here during the war years, who by the very nature of business they conducted, received so little credit, the members of the government of Design School. Time for a perambulation. Are you all feeling fit? Okay, what I'll do is I'll take you through the back of the mansion, show you the ballroom, then we'll come back to the billiard room, and then we'll assemble outside and start the perambulations. May I take questions at the end? In the theory, 99% of the questions will be answered in 2012. You happy with that? Okay, that keeps us moving rather fast. Okay, let's come this way, please.